Blog Talk Radio.
Accountable Care on the Blog Talk Radio and Affiliate Networks. We're brought to you by National ACO. National ACO is one of 44 participants admitted as a next generation model ACO by the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Innovation. The company is experiencing strong growth, was nation leading in its first performance year, and has logged 5 years of successful operations. National ACO, a physician owned and governed. And population health marketplace. Welcome, everyone. I'm Greg Masters, the producer and moderator of the broadcast, known to some on Twitter as @2HealthGuru, and the publisher of ACOWatch.com. I am joined in the virtual studio by National ACO co-founders Dr. Andre Berger, CEO, and Dr. Alex Foxman, President and Chief Medical Officer. And now for today's very special guest, Andy Slavitt. Andy Slavitt is a senior advisor and member of its Future of Healthcare Initiative at the Bipartisan Policy Center, a nonprofit organization that combines the best ideas from both parties to promote health, security, and opportunity for all Americans. We're having a little trouble here connecting Andy. I'm just going to get him back on. Okay, sorry about that.
I've been disconnected a couple times, but I'm back on.
Okay, Andy, got you back. Thanks. Andy's a senior advisor and member of its Future of Healthcare Initiative at the Bipartisan Policy Center, a nonprofit organization that combines the best ideas from both parties to promote health, security, and opportunity for all Americans. Andy has decades of private and public sector leadership in healthcare, business, and technology. Over his career, Andy has led many significant and successful initiatives in healthcare, impacting millions of Americans while shaping the U.S. healthcare system. From 2015 to 2017, Andy served as the acting administrator for the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services under the Obama administration, tasked with overall responsibility for overseeing the implementation of the Affordable Care Act. Today, Andy remains dedicated to building a sustainable, high-quality healthcare system that is available to all Americans and derives value from the private sector, healthcare providers, government, and innovators. Throughout his career, Andy has demonstrated the power of bipartisan collaboration, particularly as he has overseen bipartisan efforts in payment reform, health information technology, competition, and innovation. And with that introduction, over to you, Drs. Foxman and Berger. Help us get to know Andy, his take on the state of health reform, and the performance of the emerging value-based accountable healthcare sector.
Well, this is Dr. Berger. Andy, it's such a great privilege to have you on our show. So I've always been a fan. And actually, what I admire, among many things I admire about what you've done, what you're doing, is the fact that you really have had so much experience in the full spectrum of issues that face us, both from the public sector, the private sector, and you're also been such a, I think, great entrepreneur, a really forward thinker. So it's really a great pleasure for us to have you and help us maybe enlighten us on some of the, I guess, questions of the day and, you know, that we have. But I guess before we get on to a lot of the discussion and before we get to your work at the Bipartisan Policy Center, it'd be great to know a little more about you and, you know, what got you going, how you got started in the industry, and then kind of help us understand what led you to that appointment as the acting administrator at the CMS.
Well, thanks. Thank you all for having me on, and it's great to be talking to everybody tonight. You know, I think like a lot of people, started in healthcare on the heels of a personal experience. My way back in the 90s, my roommate from college, we were about 10 or a dozen years out of college, died from a brain tumor. And he'd been sick for a very short period of time, and he had gone through, and his widow and 1-year-old twins were in a very difficult spot. And in the course of helping his widow out and their kids, it really sparked the genesis of a new company that I created, and I became a healthcare tech entrepreneur in the 90s. Started a company called Health Allies, and I was a tech entrepreneur for quite a while. This was after I'd had a career in doing a bunch of other things, including taking company public and Wall Street and so forth. And that was really my first career in healthcare. Ran that company for a period of time, then oversaw a company. I sold that company to United Health Group, and I ended up running a company called Optum Insight, and then over time became the group executive vice president there for Optum, and grew that from about $1 billion to about $40 billion. And then I left to join the Obama administration, as you noted, in 2015. Really came in and led the turnaround of the ACA and healthcare.gov as an outsider, and was invited to stay, and then served 2 years in government. So that's a bit of my history.
Well, that's great. Thank you. You know, with your responsibility with the ACA, its implementation, we would love to get your perspective on the Act in regards to its strengths and obviously some of its weaknesses as well. But also, what would you do differently to make this, the ACA, more efficient and effective moving forward?
Yeah, I mean, if you're going to do kind of a scorekeeping of the ACA, I think you'd say it accomplished some important things. Probably most importantly, it changed the compact with the American public, what the American public expects, in that if, regardless of their income or their health status or their prior health status, they're entitled to health insurance, affordable health insurance. Now, has that been accomplished 100% for every American? No. But considering where we were just 7 to 8 short years ago, we've gotten really about 70 to 80% of the way there. We've reduced the uninsured rate in half. We've had improvements in quality and costs over the last 7 or 8 years that I think have been pretty substantial. What we haven't done is we haven't really done our jobs implementing the law as a country well. We haven't had the will. There's just been far too much partisanship. So when challenges have arisen, we haven't had the ability to get through those challenges in the way you'd expect a country like ours to do. And some of those challenges are really relate to the ability to have more competition and the ability to control costs in certain areas. So all in all, I think from a law of this size, if you compare it to things that have happened in the past at this scale, like Medicare Part D, Medicare Advantage, Social Security, things of that nature, those laws all had the ability to support and change the law once it was implemented. We need to get ourselves back to a place, a country, where we could take laws and support the things that work and fix the things that didn't.
Well, thanks. That's a really good idea. Of course, with every good idea, there's a lot of good obstacles. So I just wanted to get your take on a few of these things. The first question I have relates to how do you see, if you do at all, the difference between, shall we say, reorganization or evolution or improvement of the ability to pay for care, or in other words, the insurance component of it. And then there's the other obvious component, which is the actual care itself, the delivery of care. And how much do you see the Affordable Care Act kind of focusing on the cost of the care, really the Affordable Insurance Act, versus focusing on the, you know, the actual improvement in the care that's rendered for the cost that's incurred. So, and I'm asking this because right now in the industry we're in, the buzzword is value-based care. It's all about value. And the transformation that we're in and we're involved in is about transforming from this idea of volume to value. So I would just like to understand how you feel that's going and who is leading that. Is it the market? Is it the government? And what do you think we have to look forward to in terms of that relationship between the insurance aspects, the cost of care, and the value that's provided?
Well, those two are really linked ideas, and they're incredibly important. And I think the part of the Affordable Care Act that's talked about the most, and it has the most, you know, press in the sort of general press, is the coverage elements. But as you all well know, and as I suspect your listeners do as well, the other part of the ACA that I think doesn't get as much prominence but has as much importance in terms of its long-term ability are all the components that were created to allow for the launch of things that we now know as accountable care organizations, primary care medical homes, and bundled payments, prevention offerings from Medicare and Medicaid. And that's what was primarily done by the creation of CMMI, the Innovation Center within CMS, the funding that was put there. And then how we've implemented that is, I think, very, very important. I think in the Obama administration, we set as a public goal that 30% of all payments coming from Medicare by the end of 2016 were going to be paid for by using some value or cost metric, and that by 2018 that goal would be 50%. But what's important about that is that a lot of how you pay is not just in creating new formulas. It's around the psychology of how you're asking people to provide care and care for patients. And as the biggest payer in the country, we wanted to send a message to hospital CFOs and boards of directors and people setting up medical practices that they ought to be investing their dollars in things that keep people healthy, like prevention systems and care coordination, as opposed to building new wings on their hospital, which, of course, is what you would do if you were going down a model where you were expected to get paid endlessly on a fee-for-service basis. So we're at the beginning, I think. We're in the first few years of, I think, a major change that I think we are, we tend to watch breathlessly and closely to see how it's doing. But it's beginning to get adoption, and we have, I think, some of the tools to do that. So the new administration, I think, has an important role to play in how fast that adoption goes, but so does the commercial market, and so do care providers, and so do patients.
So I think another buzzword that we have now is alignment. And I think, it just in my opinion, alignment is a crucial, crucial part of us moving forward and moving from volume to value-based care, especially with ACOs now being in the forefront of this move. Where do you see we still need changes to really bring this alignment to the forefront between the physicians, the hospitals, the skilled nursing facilities? How do you think we could improve on our current goals?
Well, I actually think it's really all about fundamentally getting aligned around the patient as opposed to getting aligned around the dollar. People, I think, are enamored of ACOs as we get enamored of every three-letter acronym that comes to the healthcare system as a way that we're going to somehow create a formula that's going to magically make everybody aligned and do the right thing. And we just know that that's not true. I mean, as long as there are formulas for getting paid and as long as our systems aligned around getting maximizing their pay, people will just end up teaching to the test. The fear is that these formulas are not about that. They're really about sending a message to say, if you do the right thing by the patient, if you keep them healthy, if you keep them out of the hospital, if you treat them in lower cost and more comfortable settings like their home, or a community clinic as opposed to the ER or the hospital, that you should be rewarded for that. And that's never going to work perfectly. These models are always going to have ways that people can game them. And so the hope is that the physician community and the people who run large delivery systems will take it upon themselves to reinforce the culture of patient care that really everything has to start with, and that they will see that if by doing that, that's not something they're going to get penalized for. And I really prefer that rather than everyone waiting around to see if there's a new formula that allows them to find a new way to make money.
Right. Well, I think that's a superb point. And given that point, where do you see the ACOs fitting in to making that happen, to creating a patient-centered type of environment for all that creates that value? Do they have a future long-term role, or are they a transitional kind of part of that evolution in your mind?
Well, I think many of the ACOs and the accountable care organizations that are in, they were originally in what was called the Pioneer ACO, that are now in the Next Gen ACO. These are organizations with, tend to be organizations with a lot of resources, a cultural commitment to the patient and health, and are, I think, leading the charge, many of them well ahead of where the payment models are in their cultural focus and orientation. And they really ought to be applauded for that, and they really ought to be challenging the payers, including Medicare and Medicaid, to try to keep up with their advances in treatment. Now, there are some more, call them entry-level ACOs that are shared savings models. Those are models that I think are best thought of, I think, as change management tools, things that organizations can put in to help communicate with your docs why it's a good thing to keep people healthy and why there can be some financial reward for it. But, oftentimes those are used as ways to do other things besides improve patient care, like capturing more volume and things of that nature that aren't necessarily consistent. So they do need to quickly evolve. I think there is an important idea that, we live in a country where healthcare is very local. There's, 305 different healthcare markets. All of them have different dynamics and are advancing at different paces. What we really want to do is get everybody to quickly evolve to a place where they're more and more comfortable being accountable for the results of patient care. And I think it's everybody's job to try to support the clinician and the patient in that process.
So with us being in the MSSP since 2013 and shifting to the next generation ACO model, we've clearly seen this rapid transition to shifting risk towards ACOs and to the physicians and so forth. And do you believe that the end game for this are provider-sponsored health plans as the holy grail? Or do you believe there's going to be some sort of other markets that will emerge and this transition will go in a different direction?
If you ask a hospital CEO who is fee-for-service this question, what if you were fully capitated tomorrow, if you were all of a sudden had full capitation, in other words, you were getting paid a dollar amount for every person in your community, and you would be able to make your profit based upon how efficient you were in providing good care to those patients. The question, how much cost could you remove from your system? And most hospitals and most people who run big organizations would tell you that they can save between 15 and often as much as 30 or 35%. And so there's no question that if we look at our cost challenges as a nation, and we have a major cost challenge as a nation, and it's not one thing that drives it, it's a lot of things that drive it. But if one of the things that drives it is making sure we give everyone the right care in the right place at the right time, most efficiently, and then you know, having some sort of accountability right in the system, as you suggest, is going to be a way to get there. I don't know if I'd call it a holy grail. I don't think there's any such thing as a holy grail in healthcare other than getting patients healthy and well. That's the holy grail. But, you know, clearly we've got to do a better job making healthcare affordable to more people, and I think that's one way to do it.
So piggybacking off of that, in terms of where we are now in with the Medicare population, we've got the Medicare Advantage plans. We have the new ACO models that are coming out and some of these other alternative payment models that you've alluded to. And then we have still about 66-68% of beneficiaries in traditional fee-for-service. So let's project out 5 years from now. And, you know, taking into account the targets that have been set forth by CMS, CMMI, where is the shift going in terms of those three? How much market share do you see the Advantage plans capturing? How much the ACOs? And, of course, with that, I'm talking about the ACOs that are going to move into risk. And how much fee-for-service, traditional fee-for-service, will be left standing in 5 years?
I think the real important part of that question is, at what point do people feel like their medical practices and their hospital practices are at some sort of tipping point where if a patient walks in and they knew nothing about the patient, they would just assume that they're more likely to get paid more for keeping someone out of the hospital than admitting someone to the hospital. And, you know, that tipping point, I think, in some part is a numerical question, like you suggest, and I think there's no question that those models are going to continue to grow. They'll grow at the pace of how effective they are and how popular they are with consumers. And I think probably the most limiting factor right now is, you know, the ACO is not a thing that's known to the public. It's not a thing that's explainable very easily to the public. And so I think it's going to be inhibited until people can explain the value proposition to the consumers that are going to be participating in them. And I don't think there's a lot of models of having something that's successful sustainably that the people, the consumers, the patients, you know, don't actually you know, feel a part of. But that's I think one of the more important elements. But the other is perhaps something that I think we just have to get a little bit into the psychology of the care provider and the physician-patient relationship and kind of the modernization of the technology that's used to support patients and kind of the generation of millennials that are coming out of medical school. You know, there's a lot of changes that happen, and they happen slowly, but over time, I think, you know, what we have to do is make sure that all those forces as they come together need to leave us with a system where we are leaner, more modern, we have a more simple system, we have one that's easier for people to access, we have physicians that feel empowered to focus on patient care and not have to spend a lot of their time on paperwork. And, you know, when we get there, it's going to be a lot of those pieces coming together, a lot of the hard work people are doing now around payment models, they're going to fall into the background. And they're going to have to fall into the background in a simpler system. And you know, we have a ways to go, but I hope people, as they're on this journey, are not discouraged and recognize that they're part of leading the path.
Yeah, I applaud that. Your answer. I think that's fantastic. One thing I do want to discuss is uncertainty. And as we all know, in healthcare right now, there is a lot of uncertainty. One day we have one law moving forward, the next day that law stopped. And as a practicing internist, still practicing, and as the chief medical officer of National ACO, I get calls on a daily basis from physicians and suppliers, hospitals, skilled nursing facilities, home health, really wanting to know when this uncertainty will stop, which way they should go. Should they sit on the sidelines? Should they invest in new technology and a new infrastructure? And what would you say to these physicians, especially, or suppliers, these community-based physicians and suppliers that are out there and really some of them not sure which way to go?
Well, there's some things that aren't going to change. And the things that aren't going to change is we're going to have significant cost pressures in healthcare. We've got a Medicare trust fund. We've got healthcare that many people can't afford. And I think, most physicians and most of the people that you've mentioned, they went into healthcare because they want to make people healthy. They want to make people better. They want to help cure people. And they want to reduce human misery. And sure, it's a place where I'm sure there's also plenty of people that are in healthcare because they want to make money. But given the opportunity, I'm convinced that most people want to be able to do the right thing and are frustrated when the system works against them such that they can't. And so, given that, I say don't wait for everything to be perfect. We have a way. We have to force the sort of change to occur, and I think we all know that there are, some of the best and most respected, care providers in the country are those that have a cultural commitment to patient care and to pushing those things forward. So, to some extent, we and the people you talked about, you and your ACO, really are the leaders. And to some extent, you're going to get help from the government in the programs, and then there's going to be other times when you feel like you're not getting support. But eventually, they're going to get there. And I think you've got if you slow down and wait for them, and I think that's the message that I would suggest goes to the people who call and talk to you about these things and ask you these questions, then we're all going to be sort of back in this kind of middle school dance where nobody's going to the dance floor and everybody's looking at each other and it's awkward and we're slowing things down and patients will suffer.
Oh, yeah, I remember those middle school days. I'm not going back to them. I agree. It's a great, it's an ugly thought when I think about it, but it's a beautiful metaphor. One last little bit here, and that is the idea of, we're in a, we'll call it a risky business, and pardon the pun, but the question I have is there any way forward for, the providers of care and basically, the ACOs and these other entities to really make this dream come true without ramping up and assuming the financial risk for the care? Is there any other way forward?
Well, look, I think people who go into medicine to deliver care, what's the risk that they should be comfortable with and what's the risk that they shouldn't be comfortable with? And, I think there are appropriate bounds and ways to think about this. I don't think people whose principal job is to make people better ought to be, at risk, in a substantial way financially necessarily, but I do think that that this idea that we should be able to make the right thing to do the easy thing to do is an interesting way to think about it. For example, if you have a patient who is going to the ER unnecessarily when they could be treated in another way. They could be, maybe they're just lonely, and, there are other ways to solve their problem. And if you invest as a practice and in the community in finding ways to have people reach out to this individual, make sure they have other ways to deal with their loneliness, and they end up not going to the ER quite as much, you ought to be able to do that in a way where you feel like for having done what you knew was the right thing, built a relationship with a patient, kept them well, that you are getting the ability to, that's the way your practice ought to prosper. And, I think Those are particularly important when we have patients that require a fair amount of resources, patients that have behavioral health issues or other social issues. They require an investment in time and otherwise. And, you know, we need to make sure that we have robust approaches that allow people who invest in those kinds of patients, invest the time, to be rewarded appropriately.
Thank you so much, Andy. A lot of really smart thoughts and stimulating ideas and great story. And we hope that you'll come back, and because there's so many more questions, and we just think that your enlightening thoughts will serve everyone well. So we invite you back for a future to carry on. But again, thank you so much for joining us today. Really appreciate
it. Thank you. Best of luck to you all and all your listeners.
Thank you.
And there you have it. That'll have to be the last word for today's broadcast. I do want to thank our guest, Andy Slavitt, Senior Advisor to the Bipartisan Policy Center, for his time and insights today. Stay current with Andy's work on Twitter via @Slavitt, @SLAVITT, and on the web via the Future of Healthcare Task Force Initiative, co-chaired by Gail Walensky, Dr. Bill Frist, and Tom Daschle, at www.bipartisanpolicy.org, and select the Health tab. Finally, do follow National ACO on the web via www.nacomso.com and on Twitter via @NACOMSO. Until we meet again on This Week in Accountable Care, for Drs. Berger and Foxman, this is your moderator, Greg Masters, saying bye now.